Samuel chapter 8. Chapter 7 ended where faithful younger Samuel was a prophet, a priest, and a judge. We don't know about the intervening years, except he was faithful to his calling. And now it's many years later. It says that he was old, but it doesn't mean that he was old and decrepit. He still had a few years to go, and we'll see. He still had a lot of strength like Moses did after he was 120 years old. Point is, he faithfully judged his whole life. He was faithful to the calling when he was just a little boy, now many years later. And you remember, his mother dedicated him to be a Nazarite, not Nazarene. Nazarene means from Nazareth. Nazarite meant either for a temporary time or a permanent time, couldn't cut his hair, his beard, couldn't drink wine, and couldn't touch a dead body. This was like a special dedication. Samuel was a lifelong Nazarite. Now he's an old man. Can you just imagine how long his hair would be? And his beard. And he had never drunk even a drop of wine. It says, it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now, let me comment on those first five words. Now, it came to pass. You find that often in Scripture. And it came to pass. Let me tell you what it does not mean. When I was in seminary, I took a class in Hebrew, and the teacher taught us this phrase. He says, now, when it says it came to pass, that simply means once upon a time. Well, bells rang in my mind. Back to Mid-City Baptist School in third grade, I learned once upon a time is how you start a fairy tale, a myth, not history. You parents know that. You tell the children, now once upon a time there was Hansel and Gretel or whatever, Jack and the Beanstalk. That's not what this means. This is saying it actually happened. It was historical. Now, that Hebrew teacher says, well, it's like myth and saga. It doesn't really matter. No, it does matter that there is a Samuel. 1 Corinthians 15 says it does matter that Jesus rose in history. And there are those that want to pawn off this theory that, well, the Bible's filled with myths, and it doesn't matter because the truth is all that matters. And they'll say it's a saga, good German word. No, it's true history. Now, it says he made his sons judges over Israel, just like old Eli had done in a previous generation. Some say that this was not a good thing, and other ones say, well, it was still permissible, but this could be a case of what's called nepotism. And sometimes politicians do this. They bring in their brother, their cousin, their aunt, all sorts of relatives, and put them on the government payroll. Now, sometimes it's legitimate because you figure they're not going to betray you. They're not going to squeal on you. They're trustworthy. I saw a documentary recently about John Kennedy appointed his brother Robert Kennedy as Attorney General, and they could trust each other. But here he appoints his sons, and the sons didn't turn out very well, just like Eli's sons. Now, sometimes this happens in business. A man starts a business, builds it up, and then when his son grows up, he says, now, son, I'm going to turn the business over to you, so let me teach you, and so forth. But so far as making them judges, he evidently didn't see that these boys had the qualifications. Sometimes a man turns his business over to the son ends up ruining it because it's beyond his pay grade. And this raises the question, well, what about pastors? I know of only a few examples where a godly pastor raised a son that became a godly pastor and he turned the church over to him later. But I've seen other, by the way, something like that happened with John MacArthur. His father was a very well-known preacher. And MacArthur, John MacArthur Jr. tells a story that he grew up in the shadow of his father, and he was always introduced to people. Oh, this is Dr. Jack's son, because he was Jack MacArthur. And he said, I hated that, Dr. Jack's son. And he says, and then when I was like in my 20s, just finished seminary, someone introduced me and says, oh, this is Dr. Jack's son. And the lady said, oh, hello, Dr. Jackson. And MacArthur said, now I am a man. I have arrived. This is my bar mitzvah. I'm not in the shadow of my father anymore. You ought to hear him tell the story. But I've seen more cases where the son is not equal to the father. You remember the great Francis Schaeffer, and his son, Frank, once known as Frankie, turned his back on not only evangelicalism, he became Greek Orthodox, and last I heard, he's basically an agnostic. That's sad. But just like grace doesn't run in the family, neither does God's anointing. So gives the names of them in verse 2. And they were judges in the southern part of Israel called Beersheba. But his sons, verse 3, did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Just like Eli's son. You'd think that Samuel would have said, I'm not going to have that happen to my sons. Now let's look at some of the lessons in this important verse. One thing is, this teaches us that godly parents can end up with ungodly children. Godly Samuel has these two ungodly children. For example, grace doesn't run in the blood, but original sin does. We're all born with it, and parents pass it on down. Remember a year or two ago, I preached on what is known as generational sins. It's in the Ten Commandments that the sins of the fathers will be passed on down. And what does that mean? Does it mean all sins or certain sins? Get the tape and listen. Some sins are passed down. Just look at David. He sinned with Bathsheba, and there's that principle back in Exodus that if you steal a sheep, you have to pay it back fivefold. Nathan told the story of the man that stole another man's pet sheep and says, David, you're the man. David had to repay five times. Think about that. Five of his sons were paid back, as it were. There's one that died, and then there's Absalom, and then later Solomon went astray, so he paid it back. So that's a warning to us, parents. And so grace doesn't run in the blood. You cannot claim them or baptize them or presume, yes, they are, and if you raise them right, that's a guarantee. God gives no such guarantees. I was reading about Jacob and Esau. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, but they were raised by the same parents. You see, God chooses and doesn't always choose the children. So godly parents can end up with ungodly children, but you should raise your children properly, and humanly speaking, that gives it more of an advantage. Those children see a godly example in their parents. They learn Christian hymns, Bible verses. They see a godly example, the prayers. And so humanly speaking, it's more likely for them, but God doesn't give us the guarantee. On the other hand, ungodly parents can give birth to children that end up getting saved. And sometimes it like skips a generation. And you see examples of this in the Bible. For example, great godly King Hezekiah. God used him to bring in revival. Anybody remember his ungodly son, Manasseh, who was one of the worst kings? He brought in idolatry and human sacrifices. And then after he died, another young king came along named Josiah. Very godly. So it's like the blessing skipped a generation. We leave that to God. Now it says that these sons here, they turned aside. They went their own way. And as judges, they squeezed people. It says here, for dishonest gain, they took bribes and perverted justice. It's an embarrassment to see this. That's what we call corruption, graft. And the Bible strictly forbade that. I didn't write down the reference, but more than once says back in the books of Moses that a judge should not take bribes because bribes pervert justice, and they'll make exceptions, and they'll justify the guilty, and they'll free him, and then they'll condemn the innocent for money. And it does happen today in law courts and in the halls of politicians. I was speaking with a lawyer here in Springfield, Christian lawyer. He says, Kurt, I won't name him, but we criminal lawyers know there's a certain judge you can pay off. We know it. Can't prove it. He's careful. And so there are ways that they directly offer bribes. I guess the most blatant way is they store up cash, put it in a paper bag, and leave it under his desk. But then there are other ways that are indirect. And if I'm stepping on political toes, well, so be it. a lot of lobbying and contributions to re-election campaigns is simply bribery, but it's being done legally. Sometimes there'll be a politician and he's thinking of retiring, so someone, they don't give him money, they say, well, you vote for something in our favor and sway other people, and then when you retire, we've got a high-paying job waiting for you when you leave office. Here's another one, I'll give you a good example of this, where a person is given the opportunity to be on the board of directors for a very famous hospital. Now, these are not volunteers. They are deeply, heavily remunerated to be directors of large corporations, hospitals, and so forth. And I think it was the Wall Street Journal exposed Michelle Obama was on the board of directors getting hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. She didn't know anything about hospital management or anything. You're going to tell me that's not a bribe? But it was legal. Go back, 30 years? Little Rock, Arkansas. You remember the cattle futures with Hillary Clinton? And they formed a ring, and anybody that knows anything about stocks knew it was a ring where 10 men had all invested in a certain thing, and they tilted it in favor of number 10 that would get all the benefits. Who do you think number 10 was? Hillary Clinton made bags of money off of this. He was investigated, and she was cleared, but basically it was a bribe. They wouldn't have done that for her if her husband wasn't the governor that later became president. Another way that people do this that are very wealthy is that they'll give large amounts of money to both candidates. They're covering all bets, like in roulette, so that they know the score. The guy gets elected, and then next thing you know, his chief of staff comes and says, okay, it's payback time. Such and such gave $50,000. This corporation gave $75,000. They expect something for their money. They're not just simply giving it to you. That's legal bribery. They ought to be ashamed. It says here they're perverting justice. The irony, the shame, is that they were judges. A judge is supposed to uphold justice. And what's the title for the Supreme Court? Justices. Are they just? Some judges are. Some are not. Even ones that are appointed, they say they are above political influence. Yeah, sure. There are ways. They read the polls and so forth. It's awful and it's despicable when politicians and judges pervert justice. And we can think of cases and you want to say, that's not right. And it's not. Jesus told a parable about the unjust judge. We need to pray for good judges and politicians and the ones that are good. We should pray that God protect them because they will make a lot of enemies. One leading senator years ago that was a godly Christian. That's a rare thing. Rare as three-headed chickens, but he was a very godly leading senator. And he says, you have no idea that when you climb the ladder of influence, the despicable things that are done behind the scenes. And he didn't give examples, but he says it's backstabbing, bribery, threats. You name it, it's gone on in the halls of Congress. Not just by the politicians, but a lot of their assistants. Anybody remember Chuck Colson? He was Nixon's hatchet man. And when he became a Christian, he blabbed about some of the dirty tricks that he had done that he's now ashamed of. Just like Samuel's sons. Now, these unjust judges and politicians will have to answer to God, the ultimate judge, who is just. And he takes no bribes. In fact, the Bible says he never takes a bribe. Of course, we can never bribe him with money, but people try to bribe God with good works. Rather than believing in Jesus, they say, well, God, I've done this. I gave money to Salvation Army at Christmas, or I go to church, blah, 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 blah. Won't you take that into consideration? Don't you realize that's no better than offering a bag of money under the door, and God is insulted by that. He doesn't take any bribes. He never perverts justice. We also need to pray for godly pastors. People will offer bribes in different ways. For example, I remember I was counseling with a couple many, many, many years ago, and after the first session, she said, well, I'm not sure what you charge. And she got out her pocketbook. What can I make the check? And I said, I never charge. Well, why not? Bible says labor is worthy of his hire. I said, the church pays me enough. And I said to the husband, I said, that's a short road to undue influence. When they pay you and they'll give you extra gifts, it's almost to sway you in their direction in counseling so that you don't challenge them. Often in churches, and I bet some of us here could tell stories about super rich people in the church give large amounts and then expect favors in return, that they want to run the church because they say, well, that's how you run a business and pray that God keeps our board and everyone else in godly churches free of all of that. I knew a judge here in Springfield. I said, you ever get offered a bribe? Well, he was a lower court judge. He says, oh, yes, one guy once dropped, I think, a $100 bill. And I said, what'd you do? Buzz called in the secretary. Secretary, look at that. Now, you are a witness. That's not my money. Okay, enough of all that. Sorted. So it says, verse 4, the elders of Israel. Now, these weren't judges. These were the elders, the heads of tribes, clans, families. That would be comparable to federal, state, and city politicians. So they come before Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Make us a king to judge like all the nations. We don't want your sons anymore. They knew the sons were corrupt. They didn't have to take a poll. And maybe some of these had been given bribes to these unjust sons. But they said, we've had enough of that. Make us a king. Notice, they didn't say, would you be the king? They said, give us someone else. They wanted a king. They didn't want a judge like Samuel. The period of the judges was over. And they said, we want a king. Now, remember, Samuel was the last of the true judges. And we find out about other judges in the book of Judges. That's why it's called the book of Judges. You remember how it ends? There was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own sight. Good definition of democracy becoming anarchy. And people say that's the way it should be. Everybody does whatever he wants to. Because there's no, we don't want any king. Nobody tells us what's right and wrong. There are anarchists that want that. But that's a condemnation upon them. But notice it says there was no king to uphold justice. And so God kept raising up these judges. And so now we find that they swung to the opposite extreme. Instead of no king, they wanted a king. Instead of every man doing what was right in his own eyes, they said, we want a king to have a strong arm. And so that happens. People swing and they're easily swayed and they'll want super democracy. And next thing you know, we want a strong president. That's almost like fascism. Notice it says they want to be like other nations. But God had chosen Israel to be different from the other nations. The other nations were pagans, and they had kings. Pharaoh down in Egypt, Caesar in Rome, Hammurabi in Babylon, and every other one. The first nation, to my understanding, that did not have a king was Greece. They wanted a, and then Rome with the idea of parliament. Well, not parliament. They had a Congress, and they had the Senate, and all this, and then Julius Caesar wanted to be the king. That's what Caesar meant. And then he was assassinated. And then off they go with more Caesars. Pagans usually had strong-armed kings that were, they were the law. Now it's interesting. Deuteronomy 17, God foresaw the day when Israel would have a king and would need a king. And that's what we'll see when God raised up David and Solomon and these other godly kings. So God did allow having a king, but they're doing this in the wrong way. Here's a lesson. They took their cue from the other nations, not from God. We should take our cue from the word, not the world. And that applies to a lot of things. Romans 12, be not conformed to the world. 1 John 2, love not the world or the things in the world. I'll give you an example of this. Here are these people going up to old, wise Samuel. And most of them were much younger. This often happens in churches where young Christians often want to be worldly like the world rather than godly like the older, wiser Christians. The older generally know better. They're not just old fogies. They're older, wiser saints. But sometimes what ruins a church, and I could name some on all 10 fingers, probably 10 my toes too, of churches I have known where the younger people brought in worldliness and it totally ruined the church. And I'm thinking of one where they fired the pastor because he says, we're not putting up with that. It happens. They're not wise, but they want to be like the world, like this. We want a king like all the other nations. What was God's plan for Israel? That God would be the king, that they wouldn't have a king, and then he would reign with, have judges temporarily, but there would not be voting. It would be following God's laws. Now, I think we still have a handout that I wrote many years ago. It's out in the lobby. On the failure of democracy. Very interesting. It's taken from the book of Judges, especially that last verse. What was God's ideal? Now, Israel was a special theocracy, but when you take away, this might sound a little technical, take away the theocratic distinctives, what was left is the example for other nations. What does that mean? There were certain things only for Israel that do not apply to any other nation. The land grant, for example. No other nation has been given a specific piece of property. And that they had certain things that were only for Israel. But in other things, they were meant to be an example for the other nations. And the ideal was, we don't have a king. We follow God's law in society. And it would be a limited government with minimal taxation. And it wouldn't be an empire. And that's what you find in the book of Judges, and they didn't want that. They either wanted anarchy or tyranny. Notice that they offered the crown to Gideon, and he turned it down. Another judge went for it, and then he ended up being murdered. Did you know that during the Puritan Commonwealth over in England in the 1640s, they said, our king is very ungodly. There was a civil war, and the a certain side supported mainly by Puritans in Parliament. They won, and the king was executed for treason against his own people. He had brought in foreign mercenaries. But then they had this godly Commonwealth period, and boy, that was the greatest time in the history of England. And the leader of all this was a parliamentarian named Oliver Cromwell, very godly. And did you know, even then, Parliament offered him the crown. If anybody ever seen the movie Cromwell, starring Richard Harris, they offered him the crown, and he went into this tantrum. He says, what did we fight the Civil War about? We don't need a king. We want God to be our king. And he says, I will not be your king. Call me Lord Protector, but not the king. Did you know that after the United States got its independence, under the banner, we serve no sovereign here, they offered to make George Washington a king. And I imagine George went home and said, Martha, what did we fight the revolution about? He turned it down. There was another man in history that deserved to be king, and they offered him the crown of Israel in the wrong way, and that was Jesus. Coming in on Palm Sunday, Hosanna, they wanted to make him king. Look that up in John 6. But they wanted it in the wrong way. They didn't want a Messiah as king. They wanted one simply to chase the Romans out. And so these are examples of how people have gotten away from God's principles. Make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But, verse 6, the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. He was displeased and very sad, perhaps even angry. Kind of like the father of the prodigal son in Luke 15, or like Eli when he found out about his two sons. So think of Samuel as being sad. His sons, very ungodly, and now the nation that he had faithfully served all his life, is, as it were, said, well, that was then, this is now, we want something else. Samuel, get out of the way, find us a king. Sad Samuel. So he prayed. And that's what parents of prodigal children or spoiled children that turn on their parents or citizens, we should pray for our nation. Because you don't have to be a genius to see the ungodly things in our society. What should we do about it? Pray earnestly. Like Samuel, he prayed for Israel. And God replied to him, verse 7. Him being a prophet, God would speak to him audibly and said, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them. That's a surprise. You think God would say, Samuel, don't listen to them. I'm the king. You're the judge. Exercise your authority. Doesn't say that. Samuel, heed the voice. Give them what they asked for. This is an example of an unusual principle in the Bible where God condescended to give people an unrighteous thing that they had kept asking for. For example, when the Pharisees asked Jesus, well, what about divorce? Jesus said, I could just imagine him frustrated. Moses, for the hardness of your heart, gave you divorce. In other words, he condescended. You were so wicked, so adulterous. God says, I'm going to allow it for your hardness of heart. How about that story in the book of Numbers? I'd like to see what the notes of Nathan were when you came to that story when the people said, Moses, Moses, you brought us out in the wilderness to die of hunger. We want food. We're sick and tired of this manna, free bread. We want meat. We want quails. And Moses, like Samuel, was grieved. And God said, they want meat. I'll send them meat, but they will be sorry. Important principle. God let thousands, tens of thousands of quails. You know, quail meat is very tasty. And it says that they plucked the feathers off, they cooked it, and when it was right in their mouth, God struck a lot of them dead. What do you think the lesson is? Be careful what you pray for that's wrong. God might give it to you. It'll be a judgment, and you will be sorry. And that's what Samuel is saying on behalf of God. Give it to them. They will be sorry. Beware of praying for something God forbids. He might just give it to you and you'll be sorry. I've had to counsel young people that are Christians. I remember counseling one in our library about 10 years ago. And she wanted to marry this non-Christian. I said, you cannot do it. Don't ask me to get involved in this. You know that it's wrong. She was weeping, but I love him so much. And I said, you would be sorry if you married him, because I've seen other Christians, even before the honeymoon is over. What have I done? What have I done? And I pleaded with her for hours. She says, it's the hardest decision. But I said, do you love Jesus or do you love that man? I love Jesus. Obey Jesus. And God, and guess what? She broke it off, didn't get married. A couple of years later, she met a godly man, got married, had two children. Do it God's way. But other ones don't. They want to marry that non-Christian. And sometimes God says, go ahead, you'll be sorry. Or someone starts climbing the corporate ladder, making compromises on the way up, is making lots of money. I remember a couple at our church in Texas. They started a little business. First year, their profit was $250,000. That was their first year. Second year, $500,000. Third year, $1 million. A home-based business, and they were hiring people to work for them. And within like 5 years, whole marriage fell apart because they could not handle money. They had prayed, Lord, bless our business, but God didn't want it to be that successful. So they started doing various other things, and they were sorry, and that it ended up. Anyway, you take the principle. Beware of praying for something that God forbids. He might just give it to you. Look at God's explanation. Samuel, they've not rejected you. They've rejected me. Now, they did reject Samuel. They didn't offer him the crown. But what he's saying is, it's not just you, Samuel. It's ultimately me that they've rejected. They didn't want this theocracy. They wanted a human king, not a divine king. I'm trying to think of the famous saying of this. Who was it? Someone said, those that will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. I know Rush Dooney said it, but he quoted someone else. Here, they wanted a human tyrant. You say, who in the world would vote in a tyrant? Often, the man looks good, but sometimes he's given signals. I'll solve all your problems. Just give me total control. January 1933, Weimar Republic, they voted in Adolf Hitler. People knew the score. They said, he's a strong-armed man. He's going to stop the Jews. He's going to stop the communists. We want Hitler. And they voted him in. And shortly after he got voted in, he dismissed the Reichstag, stopped all elections. And for the next, 8 years, great prosperity led into World War II. And Germany just crumbled after 5 years. That's what happens when God takes his hands off and gives people over to a national reprobate mind. So Israel here didn't see far enough down. They just wanted something other than God. This is also a case in point of lost sinners in general, that they don't want God. Remember, Jesus told a parable and the people were saying, we will not have this man reign over us. And the point of it is that people are saying, we don't want God to reign over us. We'll have a human dictator or anything other than God. Anything is better than one nation under God. Vic, you probably got an atheist say that to you. Anything other than a godly society. We want homosexuality and all the rest of this. That's the essence of sin. God says, they've rejected me, that I should reign over them. But of course, God still reigned over, because God has never been toppled from his throne. Verse 8, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, that would be their forefathers, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so that they are doing to you also. They took God for granted. They forgot. It was their forefathers that had been delivered from Egypt, but they forgot. Maybe they said, well, that was then. What have you done for us lately, God? I'm sure Samuel said, don't you remember in my lifetime he drove the Philistines out? They wanted to make you slaves, grinding corn in their mills. But God protected you, and that's the story. Have you not read the book of Judges? What's the recurring song? Remember I said it's like a broken record. They turned away from God, served to other gods. God let the Philistines, the Amorites, all these others conquer them. People said, God, help us up. We're sorry. God delivered them. They went right back in the next generation. They're fickle. They forgot. But that's like human beings. God had delivered them, even through Samuel. General population of any nation is fickle, easily swayed by promises, lies, money. And it's like they forget, or they didn't even know history. And yet, especially young people, they're cool and they think, we know it, and we're not like our parents and grandparents. We know it. And this happens in every generation. Some of us that are older remember when we were teenagers and we thought, we know it all, and we're not like our parents, and we don't want to be like them. They didn't want to be like older Samuel. I was thinking of an example of this when I was writing this down. I remember when, before I was a Christian, and I was a hippie, Jason, I had long hair, long beard. You know, you ever heard of Woodstock? Well, okay. And we were protesting the Vietnam War, and we had no idea what was really going on. And our parents would say, we're trying to stop communism. We said, well, communism's not that bad. And I remember the word was out, we've got to stop them there, or we're going to fight them in Los Angeles. We better stop them there. And we better look out that China doesn't get involved. And I remember all the hippies were saying, China, what in the world's that got to do with it? We didn't know anything about the Korean War. What happened in Korea? China came in. Russia came in. And during the Vietnam, the young protesters said, oh, the Russians, they got nothing to do. It's because they didn't know, and they didn't learn from their parents. These Jews had not learned the lesson of Samuel and all the other judges. Well, how about today? Not just 50 years ago when I was a young hippie. Talk to young people today. They voted in mass for Bernie Sanders, an avowed socialist. I like, at least Donald Trump had the courage to call him an out-and-out communist Marxist, and we can name other ones. Young people have no idea what communism was all about. We talk about socialism, or those on the far right saying, don't you know you're on the same road to fascism as those that voted in Hitler? Don't you see from the far left? They don't know history any more than the Jews here. Oh, that's ancient history. We know better today. Famous Spanish philosopher George Santayana said, those that do not learn the lessons of history are condemned to repeat the problems of history. These Jews were setting themselves up for the same problems as before. They got Samuel. What happened? Here come the Philistines again. Notice God says, they forsook me and served other gods. The famous writer G.K. Chesterton once said, when men will not believe God's truth, they don't believe nothing. They'll believe anything. That's profound. Vic, you can quote him on that. G.K. Chesterton. Those that will not believe God will believe anything. The mind of fallen man is not a vacuum. His heart is not a vacuum. So if they forsake God, they will serve other gods. In theology, we call that man is homo religioso. He is a religious man. If he doesn't worship the one true God, he'll worship a false god. And even those that call themselves atheists believe mankind is God. The human heart abhors a vacuum. So they forsook God and they served other gods. And it says, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed my voice, verse 9. However, and here's where Samuel's speaking on behalf of God to the people. You shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. Samuel, you're smart. You know the score. Tell them what they're getting in for. And so he begins to give them the warning. And then later, like a wise parent, will say, I told you so. Parents need to warn their children about certain behavior, that when they're little children, they're naive, and then when they become teenagers, they think they're cool. Parents would say, listen to your parents. We've been further down the road than you have. We're not as stupid as you think. We've learned a few things, sometimes the hard way. Even a free thinker like Mark Twain said this. You know, even a non-Christian sometimes picks up a little bit of wisdom. It illustrates the old parable. Even a blind hog finds an acorn every now and then. Well, what he said was, he says, when I was 18, I thought my father was the stupidest man in the state of Missouri. But when I turned 21, I was amazed how much he had learned in 3 years. No, he was saying, I learned my father was not as dumb as I thought. Learn from your father. They've been down the road a little further than you have. Samuel had been further down the road. So he says, warn them, if you go down this road, you want a king? Let me tell you what that king will be like. Parents, you need to warn your children as well. So you don't have to tell them later, I told you so. Verse 10, Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked for a king. He said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He'll take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots. He'll appoint captains over his thousands. In other words, he'll build up a big army. Captains over his 50s, set some of them to plow the ground. Kind of got a WPA project here. You don't know what that is. It's like socialized agriculture. And reap his harvest, some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take some of your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, bakers. Boy, what a jobs program. Just what Hitler did. There was virtually no unemployment from January 1933 until the end of the war. People promised full employment, but look at the cost. He says, he'll take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, give them to his servants. It's kind of like nepotism. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vintage, give it to his officers and servants, payback time. He'll take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, your donkeys, even the animals, put them to his work. He'll take a tenth of your sheep. You will be his servants, his slaves. You will cry out in that day because of your kingdom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. I like that. When you're under the boot heel of the tyrant that you wanted, instead of saying, we want a king, they'll say, God, help us. And God's going to say, I can't hear you. I warned you. Ooh, that's rich with a lesson. Look at some of the warnings he says here. And by the way, he's giving them hard words, like parents have to say hard words to the children, just like pastors do. So wise old Samuel knew the score, he knew what's what, and he knew the name of the game. So he says, your king's going to build up a big army, big government. And some people want that tyranny. You know, I mentioned they voted in Hitler, but even after the fall of Stalin and Khrushchev, Brezhnev and the rest of them, and then when the Soviet Union fell, do you know that there are still Russians that wish they could go back to communism. You'd say, didn't they learn anything? They'd say, better to be, and that's why some of them support Vladimir Putin, who was a KGB agent. People are naive. That's a fancy word for stupid. So he says he's going to confiscate these things, and not just nepotism, but cronyism. He's going to share it with his people. And he says he's going to take your land. Now God had said, you shall not sell the land. Remember what happened to Ahab when he stole land from a righteous man, had him killed. And yet governments do this. And they do it in the name of social improvement. One of my favorite writers was the great Thomas Sowell. Don't know if you've read about him. He's elderly, but he said one of the worst misuses of governmental authority was in our generation, that one case in somewhere in New Jersey, where the local city council did something, misuse of the principle of eminent domain. Anybody know what that is? It's in the Constitution. It's in bylaws of all the states, where if you're going to put in a highway, you can go to the man that owns the property where the highway would come, and you have to pay him a certain amount. That's eminent domain. You take it, but you have to give an appropriate thing. But it can only be done for civil projects like parks, highways, not for private businesses. And Sowell said, inside this case where the city council forced this little property owner, I think he had a beachfront thing, and the man said, no, I'm not going to sell it. You're not putting a highway through here. There's no park. The city council says, we're going to take it from you and give you minimal payment. And they turned it over to a land developer that was supporting these politicians. And it was upheld in the courts. That was a land grab. And Sowell was right. That was one of the worst cases of misuse of governmental authority. But that's what happens here. They're going to take your land. Look at verses 15 and 17. Boy, I could give you a couple hours on this. He'll tax you 10% in addition to your tithe to the priests. Let me sum it up. Oh, that we could go back to just 10%. You ever look at, of course, they're hidden taxes. And, of course, there's so much people that don't pay income tax, and that 10% of the people pay 90% of the taxes and so forth. But they're hidden taxes. You buy anything, gas, cigarettes, a lot of transportation. Just do a survey and find out everything you buy, you're paying taxes. And it comes out to a lot more than 10%. Oh, that we could go back to only 10%. There were politicians that said, make it a flat tax. You remember Jack Kemp? Flat tax, 10% on everybody. Everybody pays the same percentage, 10%. And one of them, a Christian in government, said, even God demanded only 10%. And you go beyond that 10% tithe, you're becoming an unrighteous king. And they told him to shut up. But 10% was the maximum that even an ungodly king would do. And he says, you'll be sorry one day, verse 18. But they ignored the warning, verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us. You can almost hear them chanting, we want a king, we want a king. Coming out with their banners and their marches, and girls with bandanas around their head thinking they're cool. We want a king. And, oh, he'll solve all of our problems. And Samuel was probably going, hey, how dumb can you get? How ungodly can you get? When you don't do it God's way, you're on a short road to disaster. So they ignored the warning. And what did Samuel do? Did he say, I quit? No. Verse 21, Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. He prayed. Sad Samuel. So the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice. They want a king, give them a king. Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. And he said, you'll get a king. And then in subsequent chapters, he went looking for a king. Samuel, they welcomed him. But he went and he prayed to the Lord, perhaps even weeping. Here's the lesson for tonight. Samuel was sad, but he was still faithful. We too get sad, depressed, mourn. We get discouraged. Pray like Samuel and faithfully just keep following Jesus. Good example of Samuel. Let's pray. Father, help us to be men and women of God, following the good example of Samuel, and not the bad example of the mob. In Jesus' name, amen.